So reading today is from 1 Samuel chapter 24 verses 1 to 22, and that's on page 246 of the Church Bibles. Or inside the service sheets. That's 1 Samuel chapter 24 verse 1 to 22. Starting at verse 1. When Saul returned from following the Philistines, he was told, "Behold, David is in the wilderness of En-Gedi." Then Saul took 3,000 chosen men out of all Israel and went to seek David and his men in front of the wild goats' rocks. And he came to the sheepfolds by the way, where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. Now David and his men were sitting in the innermost parts of the cave. And the men of David said to him, "Here is the day of which the Lord said to you, 'Behold, I will give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it shall seem good to you.' Then David arose and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. And afterwards David's heart struck him, because he'd cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do this to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing he is the Lord's anointed.' So David persuaded his men with these words and did not permit them to attack Saul. And Saul rose up and left the cave and went on his way. Afterwards, David also arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, 'My lord, the king.' And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the earth and paid homage. And David said to Saul, 'Why do you listen to the words of men who say, "Behold, David seeks your harm"? Behold, this day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you today into my hand in the cave. And some told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, "I will not put out my hand against my Lord, for he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand, for by the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and did not kill you, you may know and see that there is no wrong or treason in my hands. I have not sinned against you, though you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb of the ancients says, 'Out of the wicked comes wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you.' After whom has the king of Israel come out? After whom do you pursue? After a dead dog? After a flea? May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between me and you, and see to it, and plead my cause, and deliver me from your hand." As soon as David had finished speaking these words to Saul, Saul said, "Is this your voice, my son David?" And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. He said to David, "You are more righteous than I, for you have repaid me good, whereas I have repaid you evil. And you have declared this day how you've dealt well with me, in that you did not kill me when the Lord put me into your hands. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him go away safe? So may the Lord reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now, behold, I know that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Swear to me, therefore, by the Lord, that you will not cut off my offspring after me, and that you will not destroy my name out of my father's house." And David swore this to Saul. Then Saul went home, but David and his men went up to the stronghold.
Thanks very much, Tom, for reading of Beres, for leading us. And let me say my welcome as well. My name's Andrew, one of the pastors here, and it's good to see lots of you here. Just, I want to underline Beres's advert for the Investing in Marriage Day and the Parenting Day. And we've been going on about it a lot, but these are really, really good opportunities. So I think lots of married couples in the church go go to this every year, and it's just a good opportunity to look at the foundations of Christian marriage and to work through struggles, because every marriage has struggles. It sort of raises things, means you can pray together, and I think it's really helpful for the health of our marriages. So I'd say if you possibly can go, then do go. And if you're not married or you can't go, let's pray for those who are married, for marriages in the church, and that would be a really useful day. And similarly, the parenting thing, it's not, we don't do it every year. It's sort of a once every few years thing. And so, again, a really good opportunity. If you've got children, I think above 10, it's focusing on this time. And Marcus and Lena Nodder, who've got 4 children, and they've all made it safely past 10. I think they're all grown up now. So they've got a lot of experience about the ups and downs of parenting. So I think it'll be very practical. And again, you probably want to be there if you've either got children of that age or about to have children that age. Or, you know, if your grandparents have children that age or godparents of children that age, and you want to be a help to parents. So we really want to pray for marriages and families and parenting within Grace Church Greenwich. The devil's attacking it in our culture, and we need all the help we can get. So I do commend that to you. Well, we're in 1 Samuel for this, the third in this series, as Beres said, on God's providence, God being in charge. And we're looking at a different aspect of providence each week. And this week, number 3, the title I've given is God Gives in His Good Time. God gives in His good time. And by good time, I mean later than we would like Him to do it time. So we're thinking about today about waiting for the Lord. God, who's in charge of the universe, who intends to bless His people, might not do it right away. And therefore, we've got to wait. Now, it seems to me that this would have been quite a good title for the sermon last week, which I think is on record as possibly being the longest sermon I've ever preached at Grace Church Greenwich. And I thank you for your patience. Maybe you're waiting, you know, you're thinking Andrew will finish this sermon in his own good time, which will be, you know, a bit later than we would like him to. I went, you can go up and look online how long it actually was. It was quite long, even to the extent that now Michaela has bought me as a present. David, could you just hold up that box and turn it around so people can see what it is? For the first time at Grace Church Greenwich, the preacher has a large, very large numbers illuminated clock, which I'm looking at. But I thought it's appropriate as we think of, and it's not going to be as long today, therefore, because I can see. So sorry about that, and thanks for your patience. Thanks particularly if you were on Sunday school or creche last week, where the wait would have been particularly painful. But we're thinking about that, and I can see the minutes ticking by. But we're going to think about that in more serious areas of life. So not just the minutes ticking by till the end of the sermon and I've left the Sunday raced in and, you know, whatever it is. But what about if you have to wait a long time for something more serious to you? So what if you have to wait a long time for your health to get better? Or a long time, in my stepfather's case, a long, long time for an NHS appointment that, well, you have quite a painful medical condition, but the waiting list are ages and you have to wait. Or what if you have to wait a long time for that relationship that's going to last, that's going to be the person you can spend your life with? And there's lots of disappointing false starts and it's been a long time. You think, will I ever get married? What if you have to wait a long time for relationship security, if it ever is going to come at all? What if you have to wait a long time for financial security, or even the longer you go, the more insecure things look? You know, when it's not just a trivial thing, but a serious thing, and you kind of know in theory God's in charge, and maybe you believe that, you know, in the Bible, but it's just He doesn't do it now. And the longer you have to wait for it, the more your faith is tested. Is God going to do it at all? And that's what today is about. We're going to think about that subject together. And I love the children's talk, waiting. I mean, when you're a child, you know, waiting for dinner just seems unbearably long, doesn't it? Or waiting for your birthday when it's tomorrow. I mean, just, in fact, it's my, I saw my nephew yesterday. He's 5. Well, he's going to be 5 on Tuesday. He's already beside himself with excitement. And the idea of waiting until Tuesday seems like eternity. And I thought that's very helpful from Boaz. A brilliant children's talk I once saw on this from one of our students at the Cornhill training course was he said, I've got this toothbrush, and I wish I had it with you because the illustration is a lot better if you actually can see it. Hi, welcome. Do you come take a seat? Very welcome. He had a toothbrush, and he said, this toothbrush, it's gone a bit weird. So you turn it on, and it takes ages before it actually starts. And we're like, okay. And he turned it on and he said, yeah, it won't start yet. And you know, you'll think it'll get to the point you think it's never going to start. And I think it's basically because the motor was so weak that it couldn't sort of get going against the friction. And so you wait and it just wait and wait and wait. And you think it's never going to start at all. And it was such a good illustration because it was so long. It must have been about a minute and a half of this motor sort of struggling, whirring, it wouldn't move. And we thought, this is a risk illustration because it's not going to work this time. And then after about 1.5 minutes, maybe even 2 minutes, it suddenly goes, and the toothbrush starts. And I wish I had it to bring with me. But the wait is so long, you think this is never going to happen. Well, here's the doctrine of God's providence. And Boaz read again at the beginning of the service. I've come to really love this. This is probably the third week we've read it out, I think. It's from the Heidelberg Catechism, which is a bunch of people in the 16th century thinking about the Bible. So it's an old summary, but it's a really good summary of what the Bible says in a very profound way. God is in charge of the world. God's providence is his almighty and ever-present power, whereby, as with his hand, he still upholds heaven and earth and all creatures, and so governs them that leaf and blade, rain and drought, fruitful and barren years, food and drink, health and sickness, riches and poverty. And you notice in these pairs, it's both things, good things and bad things. So fruitful years, barren years. So years when you get a good harvest, years when you have no harvest. Food and drink, health and sickness, the year when you get a medal for winning a sports race, the year when you spend half the time in hospital because you can't walk at all. Yeah, the good and the bad, riches and poverty, both of them. Indeed, all things come to us not by chance, but by his fatherly hand. God's in charge of everything that happens. And that's very comforting, but you've got to wait for it. And one of my favorite songs about waiting comes from Stephen Sondheim and from the musical. Some of you know Sweeney Todd. Here's a little, I'm not going to sing it, but I'll read you the poem. Easy now. Actually, I do want to sing it. Easy now, hush, love, hush. Don't distress yourself, what's your rush? Keep your thoughts nice and lush. Wait. Slow, love, slow. Time so fast. Now goes quickly, see, now it's past. Soon will come, soon will last. Wait. And if you know the context, it's a woman trying to comfort her agitated partner, saying, chill out. You know, he's in a hurry. Don't be in a hurry. You know, all in good time. Wait. Now, the slightly unfortunate context of it is that he's a psychopath. He wants to kill loads of people. And she's saying, you know, in good time, you know, wait, you know, chill out. And I thought that's very inappropriate for this context. Although it kind of isn't, because we just heard a story in 1 Samuel 24 where there is a psychopath really trying to kill somebody, but it's not him who's got to wait. That's what makes it such an amazing story. It's not the psychopath that's got to wait. It's the person who is going to be the victim. He's got to wait. So let me fill in the backstory so that you get what's going on. So David, he's the guy, the shepherd boy who beat Goliath, famously. We looked at that last week. And Saul is the king at the time. But we've been told already, and Saul's been told already, that David is going to be the next king after him. And so when you're in power, and this is, I guess, true of all of human history and all of politics, when you're in power and you find out somebody else is going to be in power, that can make you kind of insecure about it. And it just happens all over the world. And it happens in the Bible. I guess the most famous example would be King Herod. King Herod finds out that there's a king that's been born. We're thinking about that at Christmas. And he gets insecure, to say the least. And he thinks, I've got to kill this new king because he's going to replace me as king. He's my rival. And so he gets paranoid about it. And that's what happens with King Saul here. He hears that David's going to be the next king. And he gets paranoid. And he basically becomes sort of demented. He becomes mad. So a few chapters ago, he's trying to spear David with a javelin against the wall to kill him. And he chases him and David's on the run. This is a psychopath who wants to kill David, but it's not the psychopath who's got to wait. It's the victim who's got to wait. And it's the most extraordinary story. I'm just going to tell you again, because sometimes when we hear Old Testament passages that we don't know very well, I don't know whether you're good at tuning into the reading, but sometimes for me anyway, I sort of miss it the first time round, where it kind of goes half in as Tom was reading. I'm going to summarize the story again. So Saul finds out, verse 1, David is in the wilderness of En Gedi, which is a place in Israel just by the river down south, nearby the near the Dead Sea. And I've actually been there a couple of times. So there's actually now a water park there. So in my mind, there's all these wrong associations. But lots of caves and some springs. You can go there and play in the water. But also some caves. And so Saul finds out David's in En Gedi, and he thinks, brilliant, that's the guy who's going to become the king next, who I'm psychopathically paranoid about and I want to kill. So he gets a big army, 3,000 people, to go and kill David. And they get to some sheepfolds, and there's a cave, and Saul goes in literally, I love this, literally the Hebrew expression is, Saul goes in to uncover his feet. It's got to be one of the best euphemisms ever. I don't know. People don't like to say he's gone to the lav, do they? So they, you know, you think, oh, I'm just going to powder my nose. I think people used to say in England, didn't they? Meaning I'm going to the loo. Or I'm just going to the little boys' room. Or, you know, people in all cultures, people find a way of talking about going to the loo without saying so. So he's gone to, literally in Hebrew, uncover his feet. And the translator said he's gone to relieve himself. So he's gone to the loo. And then David finds out, you know, Saul's just come to kill you, and he's in that cave going to the loo. So fantastic. So David arose in the cave and stealthily cut off a corner of Saul's robe. What's going on here? Well, basically, he's saying to him, I could easily have killed you. While you were on the loo, I was there with a big sword. And just as a sort of warning shot, rather than killing you, I've just snipped off your robe. I've chosen to spare your life, he says. And then the men said, I'm not going to kill him, and we're not going to attack him. We're going to let him finish what he's doing and go on his way. And then as he leaves the cave, he's finished going to the loo, he calls after him, Saul, the king, my lord, the king, my lord, the king. And he turns round. He's still high. Look at your robe. I chopped it off. I could have killed you, but I didn't. Okay, that's the story. It's quite a striking story. And here's the question is, why doesn't he? Like, why doesn't he kill the guy that's trying to kill him? And you might say, well, you know, murder's wrong. Yeah, sure, murder's wrong, but this is a sort of a war situation. This is the guy who's chasing you with an army of 3,000 people. And you know that Lord's on your side. Why don't you kill him? And the answer is, you don't kill him because you think God's in charge. David trusts in providence. He trusts that God orders things. And so, well, this is our first point really today. Providence means the end never justifies the means. If God's in charge, then God will bring about his good purposes without me having to take grubby shortcuts. It's actually even more striking here because there's a little echo of another Bible story. And one of my favorites, actually, probably one of your favorites, is another lavatory story. So if you think of the most famous Bible stories about going to the loo, can anyone think of another one? About a very fat guy who goes to the loo. His name's Eglon. And he also goes to uncover his feet. He goes into a little inner chamber. And then while he's here, Ehud, he's one of the judges, goes in and says, I have a little something for you. I have a little message for you, a little secret. And it's a little clever play on Hebrew because the word for a word or message is the word devar. And the word for a little something is a devar. I've got a message for you. I've got a little something for you. And the little something turns out to be a sword. And it's a pretty grotesque scene, actually, but Eglon, the king, dies. He's assassinated by the judge, and hooray. So why shouldn't this be another laboratorial assassination? Well, the answer is because God is sovereign, and Saul is the king appointed by God at the time. I mean, a terrible king, a king whose time is almost up, a king who's going to be replaced by David. Nonetheless, he's the king. So just look at verse 4. David stealthily cut off a corner of his robe. Afterwards, David's heart struck him because he cut off a corner of Saul's robe. He said to his men, "The Lord forbid that I should do this thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed, to put out my hand against him, seeing as he is the Lord's anointed." Now, this is an amazing thing, because there's all sorts of things going on at once here, but David really respects authority, even when the authority is bad. And we think about this in 1 Peter in our Bible studies. We're thinking about how can Christians be asked to submit to the government when I don't like the government? You know, maybe, you know, you've got all sorts of problems, as everyone does with their rulers. And Peter says, yeah, I know you've got a problem with the government. Nonetheless, submit to the government. And there's a bit of that going on here. I'm going to respect the one that God has ordained. It doesn't mean that God loves everything about Saul. It doesn't mean that Saul's going to be king forever. But for now, for the time being, I'm going to respect him as the king that God has chosen. You see the same thing in verse 10. When he confronts Saul, "Hey, Saul, you know, notice that I've cut off the corner of your robe. This day your eyes have seen how the Lord gave you into my hand in the cave, and some people told me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, I will not put out my hand against the Lord, against my Lord, because he is the Lord's anointed. See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand. By the fact that I cut off the corner of your robe and I didn't kill you, you may know and see there's no wrong or treason in my hands. I've not sinned against you, although you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand will not be against you. As the proverb of the ancient says, out of the wicked comes wickedness, but my hand shall not be against you." What he's saying is the end does not justify the means. Even though you're trying to kill me, I'm not going to kill you. I'll leave it to the Lord to do it. I'll wait. I'm willing to wait. Providence means that the end never justifies the means. And then, I guess a very closely related idea, providence means that we should wait for God's purposes to be fulfilled. And David has to wait quite a long time. So basically the rest of the book of 1 Samuel, we're only chapter 22, but all the way through to the end of the book, it's the same story from now on. So Saul wants to kill David. David's on the run. And we go on chapter after chapter after chapter. And then finally, Saul dies, but it's not David that kills him. And in fact, the story is even more extraordinary. In the beginning of 2 Samuel, chapter 1, someone thinks, brilliant, Saul is dead, David's going to be really chuffed to hear this. So this guy, a bit of a chancer, thinks, I know, I'll go and tell David that I've killed his enemy, and he'll be really pleased, and I'll get rewarded, and I'll get promotion. So he goes and says, oh, good news, your enemy's dead. Isn't that brilliant? And then Saul says, execute this man. David says, execute this man. How dare he rejoice in the murder of God's anointed. It's quite an extraordinary thing, I think, to trust God, to wait for God. And actually, God's purposes eventually come true. And the story of 1 Samuel as it goes on, Saul dies. And then 2 Samuel as it starts, David becomes king. And that's also pretty tricky at the beginning, because there's a civil war. And there's a guy called Ish-bosheth who is loyal to Saul. He's of the tribe of Saul. And again, he tries to kill David, and David just continues to trust the Lord. And then by the time you get to 2 Samuel chapter 5, David is the king of the whole country. And he waited. Providence means this makes sense. But only really providence makes sense of this. Like, if you don't think that God's in charge, then you won't do this. If you don't think that God will be just and take vengeance in the end, you won't do this. And in fact, if you don't believe in divine justice, you basically have to have justice yourself, don't you? I think that's why in societies where people lose their faith in the police or in the judiciary, vigilante justice increases. It has to, because if you can't trust the police have got your back, you don't believe that God's got your back, then you've got to have your own back. And I guess that's why in sort of gangland London, people take justice themselves. They don't trust the police will look out for them. It's why in places of corrupt political regimes, people take justice into their own hands because they don't believe that the state will do it for them. And it's kind of logic to that. If no one else is looking out for you, you've got to look out for yourself. But David believes God is looking out for me. And therefore, I don't have to take matters into my own hands. I never have to cross the line to justify the means. The end does not justify the means. I can wait. Even if it's a long and scary wait. Let me just apply it to some different Christian situations. It might be that you've been wronged and you want to take revenge, in which case I'd urge you to wait. You know, God will, on Judgment Day, bring justice. You don't have to do it yourself now. But it might be sort of one of those more typical illustrations or applications I mentioned earlier. Maybe you're desperate to get married and the right person hasn't come along. Wait. You might say, well, that's all very well if you'd say wait, but I'm already in my 30s, I'm already in my 40s, I'm already in my 50s. You know, will I wait forever? You know, am I even going to get married? Well, I mean, maybe not. Many people will be married, but not everybody is going to be married until the last day when the Bible tells us that Christians are headed to the ultimate marriage. And we can be sure none of us are going to miss out on that one. You know, that relationship of intimacy and security that every single person longs for, if you're a Christian and you hold on, that's guaranteed. Wait. I'm not saying people shouldn't get married. You know, if you have the opportunity, of course, get married now. But don't let the desire for marriage impatiently let you compromise about who you would marry. Yeah, I'm so eager for a relationship that I'm even gonna go out with this friend who doesn't share my faith, who doesn't know the Lord Jesus, whose life is not aligned with my. I know he's not a Christian, but you know I'm so desperate for somebody, and God hasn't given me anyone, so I'm gonna go with him. Such a tragedy to do that. Yeah, the end doesn't justify the means. Be patient. Or another one, and what about that financial security or that health security? You know, I want to get better. I want to be secure. I want to have more money. And don't compromise your integrity as a Christian or in business for the sake of cutting corners. Wait. And again, it's all about timescales, isn't it? Because, I mean, David, it turns out within his lifetime, he gets the answer and he has to wait a while for it. But then eventually Saul died, David's king. But what about if it's longer than that? Someone was asking me this week, she said, Andrew, do you help us with situations where people wait their whole life and it never gets better? Because that will be some people here. And again, that's not the deadline, is it? Like if there is a resurrection beyond the grave, then within your lifetime isn't the deadline. You know, again, all of us are headed for financial prosperity and security. There's a whole false teaching in the world, a kind of twisted gospel that people sometimes call the health and wealth gospel or the prosperity gospel. And it's Christian pastors promising people, if you trust Jesus, then your business will go well. If you trust Jesus, you will be healthy. If you trust Jesus, expect success. And it's this sort of feel-good message. And particularly people teach it to the most vulnerable people in the world. So it really thrives in areas of poverty. You're in poverty, but if you trust Jesus, you won't be in poverty anymore. And it often goes with massive financial abuses by pastors. If you trust Jesus and you give me a lot of money as the pastor, then God will bless you. And it basically is a way of exploiting vulnerable people for the sake of the pastors getting rich and getting greedy. And shockingly, this happens all over the world. But you know, it's a quite a subtle error, actually, because trust in Jesus and it will go better for you is true. Trust Jesus and you'll prosper is true. They've just got the time scale wrong. Because the Bible doesn't say trust Jesus and it will prosper for you in this life necessarily. But he does say trust Jesus and you'll prosper in the end. And there'll be Christians who suffer and who are even killed for their faith. And in the end, well, they're resurrected and they live in a paradise, a new creation, in unimaginable prosperity. That is our future. But you just got to get the right time scale. And if you think this is my right now, and it's your expectation, well, you're either going to be disappointed with God because he hasn't come through for you, or you're going to take matters into your own hands. And David here, he will not take matters into his own hands because he trusts that God is in charge. Now, I wanted to finish with a kind of an extended illustration of this from church history and from the life of a guy called Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And some of you have heard the name, others you won't. He was a German Lutheran pastor in the 1920s, 1930s of the last century, at the time of the Nazis. And really a wonderful man. And I particularly like the story of him because I was listening to Radio 4 the other day, and they're talking about Martin Luther, the reformer who began the Protestant movement. And this little Radio 4 history program is really annoying, actually. I found it very annoying because rather than saying, you know, Martin Luther rediscovered the authority of the Bible, which he did, and rather than saying Martin Luther discovered that through Jesus, we can have a clear conscience because we have Jesus' righteousness, which he did. Like that, in my mind, those are the main things about Martin Luther. Instead, they said Martin Luther decided that you should resist authority and follow your own heart. This is very sort of, it's a very 21st century reading of Martin Luther. And they also said, oh, of course, Martin Luther was a terrible anti-Semite. He hated Jews. And sadly, that is true. There's lots of good things about Martin Luther, but he was anti-Semitic. And people say, oh, you know, the Nazi regime probably owes its legacy to Martin Luther. And so it was a kind of typical BBC, Christians are terrible, look at how they're basically responsible for the Holocaust. It's a bit rich, even though, you know, Hitler was an atheist and was inspired by the atheist philosophy of Nietzsche. But nonetheless, it's Christians' fault because, like, of course, this is the BBC. So I found that pretty annoying. But I wanted to sort of fight back, not to say Martin Luther was a great guy, because he was a very mixed guy and he was anti-Semitic. But by pointing about at the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, he was a Lutheran pastor in the same church founded by Martin Luther. But he was not an anti-Semite. And in fact, he opposed the teaching of the Nazis publicly. He formed part of a breakaway denomination in Germany in the 1930s. The Nationalist Church, this is quite shocking. In 1933, the Nationalist Church passed a resolution to apply the Arian paragraph within the church, meaning all pastors and church officials of Jewish descent were to be removed from their posts. Moreover, in November, a rally of 20,000 German Christians, or so-called Christians, demanded the removal of the Old Testament from the Bible. It's pretty radical. Because it was written by Jews. Okay, so this is this madness in the 1930s. And just a few of them stood up to it. They said, this isn't what the Bible says. And anti-Semitism is not biblical. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer was one of these guys. So yeah, Martin Luther may be a bit anti-Semitic, but Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a real Christian hero, defending the Jews when no one else in the country had the courage to do that. Of course, there are lots of people who didn't go along with the Holocaust, but people weren't outspoken about it, because if you were outspoken about it, you got in trouble. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer's writings were banned, and then he was imprisoned. And then in 1945, he was sent to a concentration camp as a Christian standing up for the Jews. Well, I love him as an example of this principle because just like David, he trusted that God was sovereign. And just like David, he was willing to wait. I'm going to read you a couple of things from him and then we'll draw things together. Here's a little account of his execution. 9th of April 1945, Bonhoeffer was stripped of his clothing, led naked into the execution yard and hanged. One of his friends writes of somebody who saw the execution. I saw Pastor Bonhoeffer kneeling on the ground, praying to God. I was most deeply moved by the way this lovable man prayed, so devout, so certain that God heard his prayer. At the place of execution, he again said a short prayer, then climbed a few steps to the gallows, brave and composed. His death ensued after a few seconds. In the almost 50 years I worked as a doctor, I've hardly ever seen a man die so entirely submissive to the will of God. You might say, oh, God didn't answer his prayer. You know, Lord, spare me. And then a few seconds later, he's dead. It kind of depends when your time scale is, right? If you think, I must have all the blessings in this life now. You know, I need a marriage partner now. I need my business to be prosperous now. I need health now. If I don't get it now, then either God's not in charge or I'm going to take shortcuts to take matters into my own hands. No, David doesn't do that. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer doesn't do that. Now, just trust God to do it in his own good time. And I want to finish by, this is another song, not from Sweeney Todd, but written by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And I can't actually sing it without feeling a bit emotional because it's got a beautiful tune. It's sung to Finlandia, some of you know that tune. We rest on thee, our soul, our strength and our defender, that tune. I'm not going to sing it because the combination of the words and the music is just too much for me emotionally. But listen to these words, this testimony to this same point. By gracious powers, so wonderfully sheltered. This is what he writes as he's in the concentration camp. By gracious powers, so wonderfully sheltered and confidently waiting, come what may. We know that God is with us night and morning and never fails to meet us each new day. Yet are our hearts by their old foe tormented. Still evil days bring burdens hard to bear. Oh, give our frightened souls the sure salvation for which, O Lord, you taught us to prepare. And then here's the most amazing verse of all, I think. And when the cup you give is filled to brimming with bitter suffering, hard to understand, we take it gladly, trusting, though with trembling, out of so good and so beloved a hand. That's the confidence of somebody who believes in providence. God's in charge of the good things that happen to me and the bad things. God's in charge of me being arrested. He's in charge of Adolf Hitler being, for now, in charge of Germany. And, you know, God's good time, he'll remove that tyrant. And in God's good time, the gospel will return to the church in Germany. And in God's time, he'll lift me up. And now I'm ready to die. God's providence means we wait. And I don't know about I just guess this is an absolutely life-changing truth. And I look at all these faces, I don't know. I mean, some of you, I know the situation, but lots of you, I don't. And there'll be things that you would like God to do now. And there'll be ways in which you're tempted to take shortcuts to make them happen now. God's not done it, so you'll do it. Vengeance against somebody. A relationship that will be bad for you, but you just want one. You can't wait anymore. Whatever it might be. And David says, no, I'll trust God to do it. Let me just read again these verses of verse 11, 12, 13. Just think of David holding the corner of the robe that is cut off. So easily he could have done it, but he wouldn't. See, my father, see the corner of your robe in my hand. The fact I cut off the corner of your robe and didn't kill you, you may know. And see, there's no wrong or treason in my hands. I've not sinned against you, although you hunt my life to take it. May the Lord judge between me and you. May the Lord avenge me against you, but my hand shall not be against you. As the proverb says, out of the wicked comes out wickedness. You know, the end justifies the means, says the wicked. No, my hand shall not be against you. Against whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog, a flea? May the Lord therefore be judge and give sentence between you and me, and see to it and plead my cause and deliver me from your hand. That would be a great memory verse, wouldn't it? When wronged, when wanting vengeance, when wanting things to be sorted out now, when having to wait. Verse 13, may the Lord be judge. May he give sentence. May he see to it. May he plead my cause. May he deliver me. And I'll wait. Well, we can take a pause, and maybe in the pause, you want to pray for a particular area where you need patience. Patience is a particularly Christian virtue, one of the fruit of the Spirit. And patience that doesn't make sense for an atheist. And what are you waiting for? No one. I mean, it's just the word's random. You might as well make your own good fortune. Doesn't make sense to wait as an atheist, but it does make sense for a Christian who believes in providence. So maybe there's an area where you need to be patient and wait for the Lord. And let's take a moment of silence just to pray ourselves. Maybe whoever's praying can give us sort of a minute or so, just out of silence, and then we'll be led in prayer together. And then Q&A, if you want to ask me things, you can do that in a second.